unit, operating unit. So I think I was struck by this idea, which is very simple and maybe which would be probably much more difficult to implement than what I've said. But I think this is a piece to something to explore, and that would be probably more bring more success on having a simple asset liabilities approach, which frankly I'm not sure many users understand.
Thank you. Simon?
Thank you. I'd also like to come back on Wayne's question, contrasting the property business with the retail business. I wouldn't pretend to have an answer about how you would distinguish, but I think one recent document that is helpful in that perhaps is the part of the US Fair Value Standard FAS 157, where it talks about an in-exchange value, contrasting that with an in-use value. And depending on what type of market participant you were assuming, you could get to two different values. A chain of retail businesses, there'll be an in-exchange value for each of those locations individually, which could result in that being used for a different type of retail business by the new owner. But there'll also be an in-exchange value for groups of retail locations or for the business as a whole. I imagine there could be sort of many different solutions to the question of which measurement basis to use, which would enable you to, or a user of the financial statements of that chain of retail businesses, to make an estimate of what the in-use value is, and the debate about fair value versus historical costs. There could be an opportunity there, I think, for some common ground, because one might be able to show in-use value directly, and it might be relevant where part of the business is soon to be sold off as an asset held for sale. But on the other hand, the mixed measurement model we have today probably would give users enough information to estimate what the in-use value of part or all of the business is.
Gerard.
Thank you. On the main questions, I agree with the fact that in management intent is a rude word, so I would try not to avoid. I would try to avoid using, but I would say that we had an experience in France in 2005 when we adopted IFRS, and quoted real estate companies on Paris Place wonder if they would have, let's say, interest or advantage in using fair value or not, as the possibility existed. And they had between themselves a huge debate, and finally they decided not to fair value their assets, because they consider that it would not give the proper representation of their business. In fact, their business is based on cash flow revenues and not on capital gains. But these capital gains exist, in fact, because sometimes they renew the stock of fixed assets and the sales is to an old one to buy a new one and so on. But this is an accessory to their activity, and the real base of their activity comes from the cash flow, from the rent of these assets. So, in fact, we can't really say that it is management intent that has driven the decision taken by these companies. It is the overall market which has decided that this was the best solution to value their activity.
Richard?
Yep. Just on Wayne's question. I agree. It's a choice between. For me, I think what would be important is that anyway, with the question of the retail chain, that there should be at the very least disclosure of the fair value of the properties that you've got, and then we're on to the question of whether it would be recognition or mere disclosure. And I think on that one, I think Ken did say standard setting is nobody said he said it was easy. I think he was. I think his model was setting you up with quite a difficult thing to do was to distinguish between chains of rather similar retail properties from flagship stores, which might be difficult. I think the example is a good one because I think you're on the edge of where you might say put in the fair value changes, recognise the fair value changes in the income statement and the balance sheet, and where you might leave it just as a disclosure. And I think I would have thought one of the key things is there a real option here for the management to unlock the fair value out of the retail chain? And I would have thought we can see quite a lot of examples in that case of where people are doing exactly that. Are taking up the option to sale and lease back, or dispose of some parts of the chain and reorganize their holdings. So I think your example is a good one, and I think the thing you ought to be looking at is there a real option to realise those values, and if that's readily available, then it must make the case for recognising it in the financial statements that much bigger.
Patrice.
Yes, the Wayne's example I think is interesting and we could stick to that retail business because good way of trying to rationalize. I've been working as a chief financial officer of a French listed retail group for 10 years. And let me just tell you something. In that group, there were a big department store chain in France with a absolute historical cost accounted, and with a huge capital gain, around 600 million euros. No need to account for that. Even if I'm put in the place of the so-called user, it's not my religion, but so-called user for accounting. Don't need to account this capital gain because all the market knows it and valued the company, including in his mind, this capital gain. The proof is that when we decided to sell it off, we made the capital gain, but the value of the company didn't change because it was already in the valuation of the company. The problem was that the stocks rose because it seems to the market that the selling of this chain means a change of the strategy, which is much more important the value itself. That's a point. The second point is still with the so-called user approach for accounting. If you want to reassess your assets at a sort of, let's suppose, that an efficient market existing at the market price, what does it imply for the owner? That if the owner of the assets maybe is renting the asset won't be the rent of the asset won't be raised because there are some legal restrictions to do it. That means the output of the asset will diminish. That means the market will oblige the company to sell the assets, pay the tax, and what will be done with the money. That means I'm sure that the Wayne's example is good, but we have not to oppose fair value of historical cost. If there is a significant fair value exceeding the historical cost, be sure that the market will take it. It's no problem of the accounting, I think, will trigger a lot of problems, and you won't be able to find the correct line because there are so many various situations depending on activities, sectors, intents of the management, appreciation of that sector, that you won't be able, to rationalize all the situations. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrew?
Just picking up on Wayne's example again, I wonder if there's a retail business, and say it's national business with a large number of stores in various locations. I'm not actually wholly convinced that people really care absolutely what the value of the property actually is. If you take the extreme example we've been talking about of the London store, it may have gone up a lot in value, but for many of these retail outlets, it's a key outlet. If they move out of it, all they're going to have to do is move into another one in the same kind of location. I think that the market would probably take into account that there will be some kind of gain there. In other locations, you would expect the management of a company to take a view on whether it's commercially more sensible to withdraw from a particular area and sell up or to continue trading. But that doesn't take away from the essential point that what this group is doing is buying and selling retail, and it's using the properties that it's in.
Liz had two hands up.
Andrew, I'm interested in that comment that sort of management will take the decision, and I want to link that decision back to the whole notion of stewardship, which has been mentioned several times. It seems to me that, and this was a comment that was made to us at the roundtables that we had in Hong Kong, it seems to me that we need to link the idea of a current value, an exit value, whatever label we're putting on a market value, to this notion that management has choices, they have opportunities, and that therefore to measure management's performance, management's accountability, stewardship, whatever label we put on that, we need to give users the value information, the current value information, in order to do that.
That's true. Let me just go back to an example, excuse me, of a major retailer we've got in the UK, which has had mixed fortunes. And when it's been recording poor sales, poor margins, poor push into the market, what's focused on is its trading performance and what it buys and sells, not the change in value of its property. And when the share price has gone up, when the market has followed it, is when they brought in a better type of clothing, they've got the food sales sorted out, and they're generating more profit from what they actually do. Now, I wouldn't argue that it may be that useful information is given from the fair value of what the property portfolio is, but what these guys actually do is buy and sell retail, and that's what investors are focusing on when they're looking at where their money's going and where the investment return is coming from.
Perhaps the users are looking at the return that they're getting on that money invested in the property, which is the retail return.
Okay. It's Bridget's turn.
I think I'm going to say this, more or less the same thing has already been said by several people, but singing from the same hymn sheet as I was at the beginning, I think to conceptualize this and try and get it into some sort of conceptual framework, we are talking about what the properties are going to be used for to get the best value. So are these part of the operating business, or are they something which you need in order to be able to do your operating business? And I think the idea of once you think you're going to sell those properties to bring them into the operating part and value them differently is probably the best way forward with that. Now, as a user, yeah, of course we like to know, and we look in the notes for the real value of a property, and that is information that we would look at to see whether it's there. But I can tell you, I've followed banks for a while, and banks that were struggling with their capital, and they used to try to tell us that they actually had a lot more capital because they had a lot of undervalued real estate. And the immediate question we'd ask them is, well, are you going to sell it? because if they sold that real estate, they wouldn't be able to operate, so they'd have been in an even worse position than they were at that time. And they weren't, so we never actually included that undervaluation of property in our analysis of their capital strength, because it was never going to be realised, and I think it's important to consider that. It wasn't part of their operating earnings. The other point I want to make is we're talking about real estate, and we can all conceptualise real estate because there's a market value, or there's more or less a market value that you can get from that. When we're talking about assets which are being used for a business where there's not a readily available market value, I do wonder whether getting information on the value in use is going to be relevant to have that sort of asset value, whether that's just going to be a waste of time for management and a waste of expense, because it's probably something the analysts aren't going to look at.
Bridget, can I ask you a question? One of the things that we've been hearing around the table is people have suggested that the measurement attribute for things should change depending on the type of industry. They've also said that it probably should change with the type of asset or liability. Should probably change depending on the maturity or development cycle stage of the business. I'm now at a 3x3 matrix, or probably more than that. And I'm wondering what we do with the qualitative characteristic of comparability at this point. I think I'm hearing you saying an organizing principle that you're using that crosses all of those industry, asset, whatever, is this notion of operating. Is that how, to Ken's kind of families, I'm trying to find the organizing principle for measurement attributes out of this. Is that really where you think that we could sort the by industry, by asset over time thing, because all of those would be sorted by focusing on operations? Is that fair?
It's the only way I've come up with to be able to conceptualize this and bring everything together. It's worth thinking about and testing, but whether it actually works, we'll find out.
That's helpful. Ulrich.
Thank you. First, I think I want to go one step back with regard to conception of the project. I know that the conceptual framework project is a very big project, and totally agreed that this should be split up in several part projects that have to be worked up. Nonetheless, I think that there are independencies in between those projects that have effects on the other projects. So I think maybe it's might be difficult now to discuss indeed about measurement and the measurement basis, whereas other parts haven't been discussed or finalized so far, which has an impact on the measurement basis. It's just a short remark with regard to the project. What we have discussed here in the table so far is with regard to the measurement basis, and I think, and I would agree totally with Ken in this regard, that there is all of the assets and all the measurement attributes to the assets or possibilities, they have a certain amount of relevance for the reader. And I think the important part is just to pick out what is the most relevant part to measure that asset. I'm not so sure whether specific industries should trigger different measurements for the asset, but I think the different classes of assets might trigger different measurement bases, and as well somehow the intent of the company how to use those assets. I think this the example Wayne pointed out with the real estate is very points it out very clear on the one hand, but I think you can find examples on the other hand as well, is because if you think, for example, of you have held to maturity assets to cover long-term liabilities. So there is clear the intent you want to hold those assets till maturity. So what relevant information does the stakeholder get if you fair value them? The fair value is mainly driven by changes in interest rate, and I think then this is an example where just the intention to say we want to hold this till maturity, it is pretty fixed what kind of amount we get by this. The amortized cost or cost accounting provide more relevant information for the reader than fair value measurement of those assets. So in overall, I think just to meet the criteria saying we won't provide relevant and reliable information, I think it's too hard to stick just to one measurement basis saying fair value fits all of those criteria because there is such a variety. And I think we have to go into a mixed, still keep a mixed measurement model based on fair value or historical cost, knowing that the difficulty is to decide which would be most relevant and reliable model to apply for which kind of assets. And second point is with regard to, mentioning the reliability. It's been discussed several times to mention, well, how practical is this and how can we apply this? I think one of the biggest problems with fair value measurement is as well just the reliable determination of the fair value. It's pretty simple for, let's say, quoted equity securities. But if you go a little step further, it can become very difficult. And I think the question is, how reliable can you determine the fair value? And then based on this, how comparable are those informations?
Ken.
It's very easy to bring this down to cash flows and predictive values in terms of cash flows. And cash flows can be past cash flows, what I spent the money on, which I think is sort of what we think about when we talk about stewardship, though that seems to be a difficult concept to get to grips with. Or it can be future cash flows in what do I expect to happen, or it can be future cash flows in terms of, well, what am I like to spend when this wears out? So it can be replacement costs. But a lot of this is cash flow predictors. Which brings us back to really what Bridget was saying. If I get an asset to a point where I expect to sell it, you know, perhaps the sales value becomes more appropriate than the value in use. And that would seem to lead me back to management intent. Sorry about that, folks. But why do I have a problem with management intent? Why do you have a problem with management intent? Well, I think I have a problem. I don't know what you would say, but I have a problem for two reasons. One is it's very subjective. And management may misunderstand their own intent at times, let's put it that way. So it's very subjective. But the other thing is that, like me and like everybody else, management get things wrong. At times, they'll actually make the wrong decisions. And one of the important things that I think that the user needs to do is understand whether they think they're making the right decision. So you may have a piece of real estate with an opportunity profit locked into it. Perhaps you should be selling that piece of real estate. Perhaps it's an area where you could develop it, and you might be able to get an equally useful retail store somewhere else. And if you don't tell the world about the locked-in value, you don't know that they're making the wrong decision, which is a little bit, I think it was Liz that talked about return on assets and things. Now, I think the trouble with this stuff is, and this is the problem for the standard setters, how do you to set the guidelines when I use which? But I suspect if we looked at any nice, simple situation, we'd readily agree on sometimes when you use one thing, we'd readily agree on sometimes when you use another. I think this missing the is management getting it wrong stuff almost by definition says, well, those are the points at which the user needs two pieces of information. The information that's based on replacement cost, if they're going to continue as a retail store, what would it cost them to get another store, etc. The piece of information, well, what's that store capable of being sold for? So your problem really comes in the situation, as I say, all these characteristics are relevant for all items, really comes in that very difficult ground where almost by definition two items become of virtually equal importance. And I don't think the board should underestimate that there will be some situations where you won't capture everything in a single figure for a single item into the balance sheet, and you can only have a single figure for a single item in the balance sheet. And some of that you'll have to make up for with disclosures alongside those items in the balance sheet.
So to follow up on your point, so Bridget's struggling banks that didn't sell their real estate actually probably didn't have to have bricks and mortar to operate. They could have sold the stuff and pushed a whole of a lot more into electronic banking and continued to generate income. So, I mean, so that's the kind of thing that... Is that what you're thinking about? That was an opportunity, but because none of that information was available wasn't possible for people to see that perhaps they had the wrong strategy? Is that the kind of thing you're after?
Yeah, very much so. I just come back to what Andrew said, and he talked about a UK retail company that had some varying success over the years. And if I'm thinking of the right one, two things that strike me very interesting. I remember a debate back in the UK when we were developing our financial asset standard and some of the items, some of the things we said in there, where that particular store said they equip their stores to a very high quality. And if you instantly compare that with market, because nobody else could use all their branding and everything, it's very high quality, in theory you could argue there's an immediate write-off, which they argued was probably inappropriate. But the other thing is, I think that they've just made an announcement, if I remember from last week, that they're actually going to sell a lot of their stores into, I think, some sort of vehicle, some sort of trust, which is going to leave the rental stream, which they will then pay, as part of the funding of the pensions. Now, I think that brings out very nicely some of the questions around what is the relevant information in any one case. And it will vary over time. It will be difficult. It will be difficult to write rules as to encourage them to do the right thing. And some of the time, that will mean capturing those things. Yeah, very much the sort of things you're saying.
Mary.
One of the things that I'm wondering about with this, what I'll call the operating approach that Bridget and Andrew and others have discussed, where a company makes its money by operating as opposed to holding assets. I'm wondering why, if we took that approach, that we would no longer write down assets like property, plant, equipment, or inventory when they're impaired. And I'm struggling with why, if value is not relevant for those types of assets or when management is using those types of assets, why we would be interested in value on the downside but not the upside. Would we simply report a loss when the entity sells the inventory or sells the property, plant, and equipment? And I guess to following on Ken's comment about whether if the statement of financial position is simply a balance sheet of debits and credits, we shouldn't be concerned. You wouldn't be concerned with the numbers on that statement. I'd like to hear some comments about whether we would stop impairments, ignore residual values for property, plant, and equipment, even estimated useful lives and that sort of thing.
You wouldn't end up just with a loss when they decided to quit using it. You could, in fact, as Liz pointed out earlier, have the asset but continue to earn a below market return on your investment if you weren't generating risk-adjusted cash flows commensurate with the market return. It's not an impairment right now isn't always just a kind of a loss on disposal thing. You could, in fact, show that impairment simply by having bad income for a number of years, right?
Well, that's right, because right now we would take an impairment and recognize it all at once, and then income looks good going forward or looks better than it would have. But that's exactly right. So I'm just struggling with that.
Bridget, did you want to come back on that right away?
I'll have a go. I think it's because I think what you'll struggle with it if you try and think about measuring all assets and liabilities in the same way and that they're being looked at in the same way. If you've got an asset which is being used as an investment in the business that you need to use it in the business, we would generally not count the depreciation. We'd strip the depreciation out of the way we look at operating cash flow, and it's down to real cash flows again. And Ken was saying, if you try and think about the cash flows that are coming. So we are interested in impairment, and we are interested in how quickly this asset's being impaired, because we're looking at when the cash flow has to go out again to replace it. But we can't put that into the same box as all of the operating cash flows when we're trying to actually look at when the real cash flow is needed and when it's coming. Probably confused you even more there.
Wayne?
If I can maybe follow on, I hope it's a follow on to Mary's comment, the comment that Liz made earlier. We received a lot of comment letters on the first discussion document and concepts about stewardship. And those of us who weren't born with it in our genes are still struggling to understand. But let's take my my retail chain, and I had a different one in mind, as a matter of fact. If the properties are on the balance sheet at historical cost, then I'm measuring management's ability to generate a return on assets based on old amounts. And management has changed over the years. If I measure those assets at some sort of a current value, then I'm looking at whether or not management is, through operations, generating a market return on the assets that are used in operations. So that would seem to me arguably a better measure of the stewardship of the current management as opposed to the stewardship of the current management on assets and inherited. And so I'm struggling to put this notion of stewardship equals business model equals historical cost and laying that up in comparison with some of the comments that others have said about stewardship equals something else. And so any help that you can give us, and I think it ties into Mary's question of when does management get credit, maybe is the question. But we'd really appreciate those of us who don't have it genetically some help on this.
Russell, when does management get credit?
When the bonus has to come, you know that, Trish. Hopefully this week. I wanted to make a couple of observations. I mean, there was a comment from one of the speakers that I think if you have quoted equities, it's all very easy. Well, of course, it's all very controversial, actually, with quoted equities, with this issue of how size your holding is. So even a very simple example, it's not actually very simple. I mean, I think some of the discussion this morning has been very interesting about opportunity and ability to sell, but also one of the things I wrote down is, you know, understand what your business is and how it relates to what you can do. And also, I've written down twice now, market capacity. And maybe one way of looking at that is on the liabilities side, that if you've got, say, a very long-term debt in issue, and that's obviously going to be typically issued at a fixed rate of interest, that interest rate changes. One of the fundamental questions is, should you capture the current value of that debt? Does it reflect, in to Wayne's question, stewardship or not? And market capacity, I think, is relevant because it's simply not possible for companies to go into the market and buy back all their debt and issue a whole series of issues of new paper on a regular recurring basis. And that particularly is true when the company starts to get into difficulties. So I think you need to try and relate what the business model is to market capacity issues. And you can have the same issue for a bank in terms of its loan portfolio. The market capacity, if there is a market to absorb sort of size of loan portfolios that some banks might have, could be way, way above what a market capacity is. So you can get issues moving from a single instrument. You've talked this morning about a single property, and you can get different issues when you scale that up to very large portfolios. And I think thinking about what your business is, and for me, for a retailer, maybe they have a core business, which is obviously selling, but they might actually actively manage their real estate portfolio. So maybe fair value, if that is a model, becomes of relevance. That doesn't necessarily mean that you take fair value changes through income or whatever, but it does become a relevant piece of information to give to a user. Then the debate is, where you're going to put it? But you can have businesses where maybe the retail portfolio is very incidental to what the market is looking for, as Bridget, I think, mentioned in one of her comments. So I think this is maybe weaving some of these strands together.
Jerome?
I'll try to answer Wayne's question. And for that, I'm going to use another dirty word. I've used management intentions. Now I'm going to use prudence. In the old historical caste system, the idea is that you want to get the shareholders an idea of what cash flows have been have come in the company within the last period, so that the shareholders can actually evaluate the return on the capital invested. This explains why historical was there. I agree. I totally agree that in this kind of thinking, impairment is an anomaly, because if you do want to give the real return on capital to the shareholders, you shouldn't impair the assets that you've put in the first place. Why it is so in the current system is that because you think at some point it is important for the shareholders to understand that the future return of the capital invested is not going to cover the cost of the original investment. So it's not conceptually right within the whole system. It's just there as a warning to the shareholders, be careful, here you have an asset, and the return on that asset is not going to cover the cost. So we are giving you a warning, and this has been made through the balance sheet or income statement, which conceptually I agree with you, is not the right way to do it. But
Liz? I have a question which is to try and help me understand some comments that have been made. Earlier on, several speakers were talking about distinguishing between trading and held for maturity. And it seems to me that those speakers were predominantly from financial institutions, and therefore we were predominantly talking about financial instruments. What I'd be interested in is in characterising this sort of for trading and for other long-term use, if we can hear from some people who are not financial institutions, and do I apply that same sort of notion that I might want things that are in the operations that are for trading at somewhat more current values, and things that are for longer term, let's say property, plant and equipment, at some other sort of cost type basis? Does that apply across different industries?
I mean, I think it comes down to what users actually want. And you know, this is key to the whole debate, really. I mean, what are users actually wanting? In terms of the operational performance, typically they want to know what turn have you made? You know, it's all about arbitraging the market, in effect. And therefore, they want to know what it cost you and how much you actually sold it for. In terms of the other kind of items outside of the trading or operational sphere, they're actually, you know, there is a divergence of thought about what actually is required. And if actually other values are useful, I think the view you tend to hear is they're quite happy having those values, but what they do not want is having noise in the income statement to actually deflect from the performance of the operations. So it may very well be that fair value of property, plant, and equipment is something users want, but potentially they don't want it in the income statement, or if they do, they'd certainly want it segregated from the operational performance.
Ken?
I wanted to pick up Mary's question about impairment, and I think you do need impairment in the accounts for two reasons. And I come back to why we produce the accounts, and it's all about information for people that need the information. So it's all about user information. One of the reasons that I think you need impairment comes back to the definition of impairment I've always used, which is not exactly the same as the board. I've always believed you've got an impaired asset when you look at an asset and say, sod it, I wish I hadn't bought that one. And it seems to me that in terms of historical information, you should be telling your users when you hit that point. You know, you tell them what of their money you have spent, and you tell them those times when that you wished you hadn't spent the money, or you now realise you wish you hadn't spent the money. So I think there's an important piece of user information there. But the other thing is that by asking the question, obviously we are talking about assets which are carried at some sort of historical value. Otherwise, you wouldn't be getting into impairment. If it's at some sort of current value, it wouldn't be the question wouldn't be relevant. So that raises, under what circumstances do you want historical information? And I referred to buying desks and things, and they're not got much resale value, so you're carrying them. Why are you carrying them? If you've spent the money and it's a sunk cost, why aren't you just writing them off at that point? It seems to me that the only reason for carrying them is because you have still got the asset. It stops you having to replace the asset. You're using it over a period of time. And therefore, you need to sort of say what those assets are. But there is an implicit assumption in there, and it comes back to, I think, most of this stuff is about cash flow predictive information. There is an underlying assumption that you, having got the asset and carrying it as an asset, you will recover the asset. And therefore, if you get to assets that you know you won't recover, I think there is predictive cash flow information in telling people that asset is no longer the asset that I thought it was. It actually has a lower use as an asset. And therefore, you've got to take out that bit of the historical amount you put in that ceases to be relevant as an asset. And it's to do with the predictive cash flow nature of that information, which has limited predictive cash flow information, I know, but to the extent that it has it, you mustn't mislead people by making out there's more there than there is.
Can I ask you what you mean by recover? Because that's the point that I added to Mary's. Because do you mean that I'm not going to get as many currency units as are sitting on there, or that I'm going to recover a risk-based return on the investment in the asset? This is kind of important.
Yeah, it is. And I think it is the risk-based return. I'm not going to get as many monetary units, but by holding the asset, I'm using up monetary units as well. So not only is it the monetary units I'm going to get, I want it to compensate me for the monetary units that are being used up. Now, I think that does, we can debate around what that means, but I think that essentially comes back to a net present value on a risk-based return.
Two hands, Mary.
I think I understand what you said, but what I'm struggling with is,
it's my English accent.
Yeah, I know. I'm learning, actually. It seems to me you could make exactly the same arguments you just made on the upside, that you're going to tell financial statement users that you're going to realize more than what was the asset was. And I don't understand the question I raised before. I don't understand why it's more important to understand the downside than the upside.
I absolutely, and nothing I've said this morning should have suggested otherwise, you can tell people the other piece of information. Totally agree. And it's just whether it's particularly relevant to tell them what is the most important information. We've got, 19 characteristics listed down here? 19 characteristics that are relevant for every single item. Now, if we give them all 19 pieces of information for every single item, it's probably going to sink them in information. So it's what do you give them, what is useful. So if I take an item being a building I bought for increase in value is very relevant. If I take an item which is a car I have just driven out of the car showroom for one of my salesmen, what I could sell it for at that point of time is interesting but not particularly useful information at that point in time. You've got to decide of your 19 characteristics what you give them. And for different items, different information will have greater relevance. So you could take all 19 of your items, and I bet you I could come up with another 19 or another 190. You could list them down and say, I want to give all those pieces of information. Now, I think in different situations, and the difficult job of a standard setter is deciding how you help people define those situations, how you constrain the use of them. Different situations, you'll say, that one's really important to me in this situation, that one's less important to me, that one's more important to me. Is getting that balance. It's finding which are the most relevant in each situation. Driving the car out of the showroom, the immediate sort of sales value, less transaction cost to sell, will not be the most useful, relevant information to most users. For a financial instrument that is in a really active market, it probably is.
Patrice, you had your card up. Have you changed your mind?
No, but to try to answer the question, I don't understand, frankly, the debate, because to show an impairment is just to tell to the, okay, I lost a part of the amount I've invested. By the way, I increased my return. On the contrary, it's a question of, before the techniques, if we want to revalue the asset because the current value is more important than the historical one. Okay, is if to show a lowest return based on the if the accounting means I want just to tell you the return every time, please be confident to the management. If the return is too low, maybe the management will sell it, but will sell it if he knows to do something with the money he will earn. It's not only a question to sell or not to sell. It's a question to do you replace by what? And that means to convey the idea that all the time we want to try to show to the market the exact return, even or for the bonuses or what you want. But it's not a question of accounting. It's just a question of business appreciation. If the valuation is higher, the market knows it. You can say. In some particular cases, you can give the information by notes, but it's another question to revolution the accounting.
Keith?
I think I just want to go back to what Liz raised on in terms of, it's called in the assets in a non-financial institution. Clearly, we would distinguish between what would be an operating asset, and then I imagine, in the current thinking, that would be more historical cost. There might be a case to put it at fair value, but anyone who's ever had an acquisition and had to put a fair value on these assets will know that that is subject to many assumptions. For certainly delving into the thing of management intent and what to do with the arguably very little benefit. Equally clear, there's financial instruments which are subject to more clear fair value and a more market-based approach. There would be held for sale assets, something that certainly has been recognized in the standards, as well as potentially non-operating assets. Now, these are the assets that arguably are not recovered through your traditional operating cash flows and could be flagged separately. The clear thing is, I mean, all of those definitely would require different measurement basis. I think the responsibility that we should have is to make sure that there's a thread through the financial statements, through the accounting policies, the balance sheet, the income statement, cash flow, that you can link all of these together, somehow showing the different way that these asset liabilities are looked at, and also the different measurement basis.
Simon.
Thank you. I'd like to come back on the question of impairment and upsides and downsides. I certainly would support what Ken said about the reasons why actually recording an impairment loss in the financial statements is the best way of communicating that loss in value to users. Impairment's one area where the ISB or IFRS US GAAP model's currently different in a number of significant areas, and IFRS does allow some limited upside in that if you record an impairment, then you can reverse impairments on certain types of assets in certain types of circumstances, not to get you to a better position than you would have been if you hadn't had an impairment in the first place. And also there's options in some of the standards on the non-current assets to revalue, although in US GAAP I'd accept those, impairments aren't reversed. But the point that Bridget made, I think, about the bank with the unrealized property gains would illustrate why booking an upside on an asset which perhaps would require a change in strategy to before you could dispose of it, or is not realizable instantly and would take some time to realize, probably is not the best way of communicating that that upside situation to users, although disclosure, of course, could be highly relevant.
I'm going to put Sophie on the spot because she hasn't participated yet, and I'm interested in a question where people have said to us, I think we've heard all around the table, that different measurement bases are useful for different things at different times. And that says to me, and one of the organizing principles that might be helpful is either what's your operations, what business are you in, business model, those are all words that we've heard too. Or I should be selling this, but I haven't. And all of those then seem to me to be opportunities or occasions on which, if the business model changes, the operation changes, those ought to be circumstances in which I change the measurement basis because I've moved to something where, to Ken's point, the more relevant information is different. And I guess one of the things that we know about regulators in general, and securities regulators in particular, is that they tend to like some consistency between entities and over time. And I guess if we start developing this kind of thinking, how comfortable do you think you and your colleagues are going to be with essentially leaving the measurement basis as something that's driven by what people define to be operating or not? That's it's a, I know Ken said we need to identify the bases on which what's the most relevant basis at a certain point in time for certain kinds of assets. I guess the question is, how do we or should we be attempting to narrow the measurement bases that people can use down in some way? And if so, how do we do it?
That's a very difficult question because I think that it's typically something that we would like the standard setter to try to enlighten us on this kind of issue. It's difficult to say. It's true that we push very much and we look very much for some consistency when companies need to apply and develop their accounting policy. But at the same time, it's just, to the best of my knowledge, it's not consistency for all companies in general. It's rather consistency within certain businesses, certain industries. And I think, to a certain extent, what we've heard so far is, at least from what some speakers said, is that there is pretty much this link that needs to be made between the business model and things, how things are explained. So, if things are sufficiently narrow down so that companies can be in a position to, within the several activities, the several segments that they are operating, can have a I would say, consistent way to measure their operating results, then it would be, I think, a great benefit. But at the same time, it's not very easy because, as we've said, there are obviously strategies that varies from time to time, and it's not an anomaly. It's just being taking opportunities as they are, as the markets develop. So that's, for me, it's also something that may be also, I would say it's not really something that should be precluded, or it's just around certain set of circumstances in certain industries, allocating some measurement basis to these items might be a helpful and good exercise. But to go back to your earlier question, I'm not sure that we would look for consistency in general, but rather consistency applied in certain areas, in certain industries, and it's probably also things that users would like to see.
Richard.
Yeah, it was just a quick point on point about impairment. I think probably, and I don't wish to add to your workload, but there's been some very, very interesting studies on behavioral economics about what people actually do in real life, because economics has been somewhat primitive in its outlook in saying that upside and downside should be treated equally, and that clearly isn't the case. So one thing I would say is that that does have ramifications for not only things like impairment, where I think a down signal is far more important than an up signal, but also goes on into some of the base models which people use for fair value, etc. So actually potentially would undermine some of the fair value models that we have in place.
Thank you. Ken?
Just a quick point on this. Could you produce characteristics? As I say, I wouldn't underestimate how difficult it's going to be. It is difficult. But it is something that standard setters have done before, and I just point at the normal usage requirements for embedded derivatives in IS39. maybe even worse than management intent, but you know, those were put there for this sort of reason, I believe.
Sharon, did you change your mind?
Well, I was wondering if I was going to say a third horrors, or, but because of the question you asked to Sophie, you know, there's undermining these things. There is this whole debate of, well, companies and auditors are not going to be able to identify what is the core business or the operating business of the companies. And this is something that we've heard for ages. But I've never been an auditor, but frankly, it's hard for me to imagine that somebody doing his job with seriousness would not be able to identify clearly what is the core business of the company it is auditing. And this thing has been on and on, but this is something I don't understand.
Russell.
I think there is real real mileage in you exploring this concept, but if you do so, obviously the devil's in the detail. And I think you've got to reflect on the fact that business models will change over time and that you need to come up with whatever word you call it, a framework or whatever the current flavour is, that does accept that a company's business model will change over time, either because it changes what it does or because the market around it changes and creates new opportunities to capture value that didn't exist before. The other thing I'd say is that I have no difficulty with, and I've always believed it to be a good thing, that management should set its stall out, should say what it is trying to do, and it should be held accountable for its actions. So the idea of management actually postulating this is what we do and coming up with a view that is along those lines and then being held to account for that, I think is actually a very good thing.
Philippe.
Just a quick remark or question on this idea that when the business model changes over time, that might trigger a change in the valuation basis. It makes sense. One difficulty is to decide when we give a translation to that. Today, we have a standard which says you have a discontinued operation and you change the measurement basis on classification, but you need some objective evidence before you can do that, because we don't trust management intents. But maybe the day before, if I have to close my books, just a point in time before I can have this objective evidence, you say, no, you can't, at that point, give effect to your intent to discontinue that operation. And the question I have maybe for this group, is does that make sense to say no, we don't trust management enough to give effect to a change in a measurement basis? You must have some objective evidence before you can do that. Is this for the best? Of course, it is easier for auditors, it is easier for regulators, it is easier for many people because evidence is there. But is that the best type of information you give to users?
Opinions?
Well, several people have suggested, Russell most recently, that we ought to focus on the business model, which I have a sneaking suspicion is another word for management intent. So, Ken, we've found a way to cleanse your words there. But I'm struggling to understand how business model would tell me what the measurement attribute is for the assets and liabilities used in that business. You can tell me that I don't want to show current values. You can tell me that I don't intend to realize them, and maybe that has something to do with it. But how does business model tell me anything about measurement? Or is it just, as Ken seemed to suggest, a if not free choice, a really open one? How do I link those two together? I think that's what some of us are struggling with. I think that's a little bit of what Philippe was struggling with.
Ken, you have an answer?
Sorry, I'm speaking much too much, but people keep asking me these questions. I wasn't advocating a free choice. I think it would have to be very constrained. But as I say, if you start at the easy end, I think there are some things where you'd say clearly exit fair value is the right measure. And I'd say for financial instruments in good markets, that's a pretty good starting point. It's debatable, but it's a pretty good starting point. If I take some other stuff, such as, you know, cars driven out of showrooms and office furniture, I know those are pretty small fry stuff, but I think that the concept of an exit value for something that you're just going to use and grind into the ground and get rid of starts whether on grounds of practicality or usefulness. Now, as you move from those two ends of the spectrum, it gets very difficult. Sorry, I was practically using another inappropriate word. It gets very difficult, particularly as you compare, as you say, retail companies with companies that sit on retail property. I think that the difficult job of a standard setter is to try and define some of those things. If I come back to, and sorry to be swearing again, but the normal use requirements for embedded derivatives, those requirements were put in for quite a good reason. If they're broken, it's more because the whole thing around derivatives is broken rather than because those particular bits are broken. And therefore, I think you need that sort of analysis questions how long-term this project will be. If we come back to the coloured in balance sheet, what I'm advocating is that there would be a balance sheet that was in different colours. The colours would be based on families of items rather than 19 different characteristics. And you would know why you'd got a particular colour for a particular item. And different companies would have different tonal experience between their activities. But if this stuff is achievable, I think that you could put constraints, and as you found the constraints didn't work, you'd narrow the constraints down. I think that there's an awful lot of it can be driven by the users. We come back to the banks where they're sitting on huge profit in their properties and somebody said, you know, the market knew. I think if the market's got a feeling that you're sitting on a lot of profit, they'll beat the information out of you eventually. So I think the market does have quite a lot to offer. But I'm not suggesting a free-for-all. I'm not suggesting that you set out four characteristics and say, there you are, choose which ones you want. I think the standard setter has to put some real constraints on that. And I think the difficult part of this project is iterating between starting to decide what the users want, working as much with the users as you can. I know they're much more difficult to get at than some other commentators. Start with them, looking at what families of characteristics sort of work towards that, and iterating round and round. And perhaps trying this as some requirements, then moving them on in due course when you find they don't quite work, get abused or whatever.